Hi, I'm Lauren Gilger, co-host of the show, one of KJZZ's original productions. It's a program with news and features from across Phoenix and the state. You can find much more at theshow.kjzz.org. Here's today's episode.
Good morning. It's the show here on KJZZ 91.5 in Phoenix. I'm Mark Brody.
And I'm Lauren Gilger. Coming up, why thousands of trans people in Arizona could be impacted by strict voter ID laws.
And Maricopa County Supervisor Bill Gates is not running for re-election, but he will be staying in the world of elections.
But first, the Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals ruled the Maricopa County Sheriff's Office's practice of posting mugshots online is unconstitutional. It stemmed from a case involving an Arizona man, Brian Houston, who was arrested for assault in 2022. His mugshot was posted online for 3 days, as was the department's practice. But the charges against him were dropped. He never went to trial. Houston argued in court that the posting of his mugshot, including his name, birth date, sex, weight, height, even hair and eye color, caused him public humiliation. The appeals court said that posting the mugshot violated Houston's right to due process. Detainees are supposed to be presumed innocent until they're found guilty. The decision is about the MCSO, but it could have far-reaching implications for departments across the country. Here in Arizona, the Arizona Republic reported MCSO and some other Arizona counties have already stopped the practice. Journalist Carrie Blakinger has written about the debate over mugshots before, and she's experienced this herself. She is a reporter for the Los Angeles Times and author of Corrections in Ink, a memoir about her own time in prison and what led her there. I spoke with her more about it.
I think that a lot of the reason we're seeing some of this change is that people have started in recent years just rethinking the role of journalism, but also I think rethinking how we view the legal system. I think there's been a lot of sort of progressive changes in recent years that have caused a sort of broader rethinking. And I think some of this is the result of Black Lives Matter and the impact that that has had. And I think that some of it is just, sort of large scale sea changes.
Yeah. Okay. So let's talk about mugshots in particular and posting them online. The argument for releasing mugshots like seems pretty obvious. Like if you need to find a suspect or a missing person, something like that. But other than that, like, what is the public safety interest in releasing mugshots?
Well, I mean, it's really hard to sort of pin down what public safety interest there would be other than those specific situations that you've mentioned. I mean, I think law enforcement frequently pivot to like, oh, well, we might need them if there's a dangerous suspect on the loose. And typically in states where they have, or municipalities where they have regulated or tried to dial back when they're releasing these, they've often still allowed exceptions for that specific scenario. But other than that, there typically isn't an easy to define clear public safety purpose. Sometimes I've seen law enforcement say that this is a deterrent, but there's no real evidence that posting mugshots is any kind of deterrent.
So talk about then the other side of this, right, which is what it can do to people's lives and what we've seen it do to people's lives in several cases, like the one you wrote about years ago and like the one happening in Arizona now.
I mean, I think that people still inherently sort of view mugshots as some sort of implied presumption of guilt. You know, you don't look at a mugshot and think, oh, that person's innocent. So I think that they end up being stigmatizing, and they end up being stigmatizing for a very long time. You know, even if you are eventually found guilty and you are punished to some amount of time in jail or prison, that ends. The mugshot continues forever, and people can use that against you. It can end up making it harder to restart your life, to reintegrate with society, to go to school, to get a job. It can make all of these things that we should actually want people to be doing if they've been involved in the legal system. Like all the things that we should want people to be doing, it makes it harder for them to do those things.
Hmm. So tell us about your own experience with this, right? Because you've written about that before. You wrote a book about your experience in prison. But tell us about, you know, when you saw your own mugshot and what that was like.
I mean, I got arrested in 2010 on a drug charge, and I was extremely high at the time. I looked like someone on drugs. I looked like a Faces of Meth type mugshot. And this mugshot, you know, was very broadly distributed. And at the time, it was such a gut punch to see it, to see that as the way that the world would know me. And obviously, I eventually, you know, I did my time. I got out. I became a journalist. I went down a different path, and I managed to do that despite my mugshot being public. I've been very lucky in being able to start over in a way that a lot of people who have had brushes with the legal system don't. But I still know when I look at a mugshot like that, that is a very stigmatizing effect. I mean, I think when you spread, in my instance, the sort of faces of meth type image, that is stigmatizing to lots of people that are struggling with addiction, not just me, the person shown in that mugshot.
Wow. Yeah, that's really interesting. So I want to talk a little bit about the way this is changing. Like you mentioned in your reporting, lots of jurisdictions around the country, including some federal agencies that do not release mugshots, some who maybe never have and others who have stopped for kind of these exact reasons without legal action. You say this is part of sort of a broader change in how we view the legal system and policy changes within it. But talk a little bit about why some of those law enforcement agencies don't do this.
So in some cases, we don't know. They don't always specify. But in a lot of cases, I think, as they've started to pay attention to the broader discussions about this, some have simply just changed policies on their own. Like in Houston, the Harris County Sheriff's Office had decided they were not going to just routinely make them available. And I think Newark, New Jersey also had decided they were not going to publish them. And there's several places that have done this voluntarily. There's also a few states that have started to regulate the ways in which law enforcement can publicly post these things. Like California had a law take effect recently that agencies can't post them on social media anymore. And Florida already had a law that would require these sort of mugshot sites to take them down if asked. Louisiana had banned them, though that law has been challenged some, and I don't know what the status of that is at the moment. And then I think New York had made some restrictions. West Virginia had considered it. New Jersey has at least considered it. So it's kind of interesting in that it's across, those are some blue states and some red states that have considered taking action to rein this in. But it is still across the country, mostly individual agencies making this decision based on, you know, realizing that maybe there isn't a specific public safety goal or a specific public safety value, unless you're talking about those rare situations where there's a dangerous suspect on the loose.
Is there a racial bias aspect to this as well?
Yeah, I think this has been part of why this has been an issue that has gotten more traction in recent years. And we've started thinking and talking more about racial bias that is baked into the system. And, you know, we know by a lot of metrics that communities of color are often more heavily policed and, you know, people in communities of color end up more likely to be involved in the system and more likely to be having mugshots taken because of the ways, you know, that we've already mentioned in which mugshots can be sort of inherently stigmatizing and can make it really hard to start over or to, you know, get a job, go to school, make a good life for yourself. Publishing mugshots, making them extremely public, can have a very disproportionate racial impact.
Let me ask you lastly about this appeals court decision, which affects, you know, Arizona agencies. We've already seen several here in the state say, okay, we're going to stop doing this, at least for the time being. Do you think a decision like that could have broader implications around the country? It is first of its kind.
Yeah, I think it'll be interesting to see if lawyers in other parts of the country start trying to bring similar cases with similar arguments to see if they can convince courts elsewhere to, you know, come to similar conclusions. I mean, this is in the Ninth Circuit, which I think is going to be much more friendly to some of these issues than if somebody tries this in, say, the Fifth Circuit, mm-hmm. which is, you know, Texas, Louisiana, and part of Mississippi. So, I mean, I don't know that it would be possible to see this sort of successful outcome on a case like this across the country, but there's probably some jurisdictions where they could, and there's probably some agencies that are going to see the writing on the wall and change their behavior, even if they're, you know, not in the same state.
Yeah. All right. We will leave it there for now. That is Carrie Blakinger, a reporter for the Los Angeles Times and also author of the memoir Corrections in Ink. Carrie, thank you for coming back on the show. Appreciate you talking about this.
Thanks for having me.
Thank you. LGBTQ advocates are raising the alarm over strict Arizona voter ID laws that were partially reinstated by the U.S. Supreme Court last month. They say it inadvertently makes it harder for trans people to vote. And a new report shows this could affect upwards of 9,000 people in our state when elections are being called here by sometimes hundreds of votes. Joseph Darius Jafari is covering it for Lookout, and I spoke with him more about it earlier this morning.
So the Supreme Court's decision reinstated an old state law that basically said that Arizona residents have to provide a state ID if they wanted to vote in local elections. And that state ID had to be either a state driver's license, a state identification card, or some kind of tribal ID as well. It is temporary. It could be changed, but that is something that will be in effect this coming November.
Okay, so we talked about this decision on the show before when it happened, and the discussion was mainly around how most of the sort of people on the federal only, quote unquote, voters list are concentrated on college campuses in Arizona. So it seemed like this mostly might affect college kids who maybe didn't bring their Social Security card with them or something like that. But you have found that this could also affect another and pretty large group in the state, which is trans people. Tell us how.
So in Arizona, we have 30,000 trans people who are adults, and 24,400 of them are eligible to vote. The Williams Institute in UCLA found that about 40% of them don't have the proper ID to actually get out and vote. And that's because of a few different reasons. If you think about a person who is going through transition, you know, you have to actually get a licensed physician to write you a letter. You have to go to the DMV. You have to get that driver's license changed. And when you think about the people who want to go and vote, when you have to present that ID, what you are presenting to the poll worker might not be the same person that, you know, is on that ID. And so a lot of different LGBTQ advocates and voting rights advocates are raising alarms because the voting ID law basically says, you know, you have to present an ID, but if that ID is something other than who is standing in front of you, that will pose issues and might force the person to vote on a provisional ballot. Now, ultimately, what is happening is that everybody is saying, just vote by mail. Right? You can avoid all of this by voting by mail. But, you know, we spoke with a couple different people who said, you know, I like to vote in person. I've never had this problem before. You know, I want to vote in person. I like being a part of the process. But I also have never felt the need to get my gender changed yet because I'm early in my transition. I don't want to get my ID changed because I haven't gone through gender reassignment surgery yet. I don't have the proper, you know, doctor's note because I haven't seen a doctor. I can't afford a doctor yet. And so they can't go through the proper legal route to get their ID changed. And so even though they are an American citizen and are eligible to vote and are registered to vote, they may not be able to vote because of this voter ID law.
So when you say 40% of this population, this adds up to quite a few people, 9,400. Is that right?
Yeah, we're talking about wins within the double digits here. So even, you know, a couple hundred people who are disenfranchised or may not be able to get out and vote, that can really tip the scales in, you know, in one candidate's favor. So when we're talking about almost 10,000 people or even 9,000 people, you know, that's a large number who may not be able to cast a vote and be you know, immediately counted. And the Secretary of State has said that, you know, everybody will be able to get a provisional ballot. And these people who may not be able to get counted and get a provisional ballot, they will obviously have to go through extra hurdles. But, you know, there's also this reality of, like, if people know that they don't have the proper ID, that they may have socially transitioned, they, you know, a trans woman doesn't look like what they look like on their ID, but they, you know, we all have had the experience of that ballot sitting on our table and then forgetting about it and then wanting to having to, like, drop it off or something like that, or not filling it out, just filling it out in person. All that to say is, like, going to the polling location with your ID, I mean, there is a bit of fear in it. You know, we spoke to some people who kind of said, like, I don't know if I will vote. If I don't vote by mail and if I've missed that deadline, I don't know if I'll feel safe or comfortable going to a polling location because the biases of the poll workers, you know, I don't know these people. I don't know what biases they have because, you know, my existence has been politicized right now.
So what does the conversation look like within the trans community? Like, are people getting the word out there that, you know, maybe this is the way to go about it, or these are the things you might want to be prepared for this time around because of this new decision from the Supreme Court?
Yeah, I mean, I think this is fairly new. I mean, I don't think a lot of people know about this. We published our story, and, you know, just on social, there's been a lot of conversation around, like, oh my gosh, I didn't even think about this. This is something that nobody had really ever thought about before. But there has been conversations within the community about, like, making sure to really prepare yourself for it. Like I said before, the conversation really has been around vote by mail. I mean, if you don't have the proper identification because you have not gone through the legal process to get your ID changed, voting by mail is a, you know, perfectly legal and perfectly fine option. You know, HRC, Human Rights Campaign, has been really pushing a lot of it. Progress Arizona has been pushing a lot of these campaigns, you know, to register LGBTQ people and then also educate trans people about, you know, the ability to get your license and get your information changed over. But that sort of thing takes time. And we only have, what, 50 days until the next, until the election. So the reality is, like, you know, a lot of different advocates and a lot of different voting rights folk are basically saying, like, the real thing to do here is register for a mail-in ballot and get it done that way.
Yeah. All right. We'll leave it there for now. Joseph Darius Jafari joining us, founder and editor-in-chief of Lookout. Thanks for coming on, Joseph. Appreciate your reporting here.
Thank you so much. I appreciate you.
Good morning. It's the show on KJZZ 91.5. I'm Mark Brody.
And I'm Lauren Gilger. Coming up, we take a trip to the Musical Instrument Museum to see some of America's most iconic string instruments.
But first, last summer, Maricopa County Supervisor Bill Gates announced he would not seek re-election this year. He served two terms on the board and before that had been elected to the Phoenix City Council, representing North Valley communities in each office. Gates was chairman of the Board of Supervisors in 2022 when it faced repeated questions and accusations about that year's midterm elections. Gates himself faced threats, as did his colleagues. He said the episode left him with a diagnosis of PTSD. Gates recently announced he'd be leading a new program at ASU called the Mechanics of Democracy Laboratory, or MODEL. That program started this fall. It'll aim to train the next generation of election administrators, as well as work to correct misconceptions and debunk conspiracy theories about elections and how they're run. Gates stopped by the studio recently to talk about this new endeavor, as well as what led him to it. And we started our conversation by talking about what was the first thought he had about teaching a class essentially about how elections work.
Well, I have to tell you, you know, over my 15 years of serving on the Phoenix City Council and on the Maricopa County Board of Supervisors, Arizona State has been so involved in so many things. We've partnered with them on various items. I spent a lot of time over at Watts College just over the years on certain activities. And as I kind of look to the future and some of the challenges that certainly we're facing in government broadly, but particularly for elections officials, I thought, wouldn't it be wonderful to keep working on this and in particular focusing on two things? One, the misinformation that's out there about our elections and being able to educate folks on it. And two, and frankly more importantly, how do we, as we look at the number of people who are leaving the elections administration profession, how do we encourage a new generation to step up and take on these important roles?
It sounds like part of your goal here is very pragmatic in terms of training more election workers, election officials. But also seems kind of, part of it seems kind of aspirational in terms of trying to make people trust elections again.
That's right. I think those two objectives are intertwined with one another. Certainly, if we don't have new people coming into the profession who have been trained in how to do it, we may have problems in the future. But at the same time, it's going to encourage more people to get in the field if we can bring that trust back for some people who are, you know, a little, their trust is a little shaken in the system.
So given all of that, and given all of what we've seen about election officials, election workers leaving their jobs over the last number of years, given threats and, you know, all the misinformation out there, how do you try to attract new people to this job?
So this is a great question. It's one that I've thought about quite a bit. And look, if you are someone who's faint of heart, maybe elections administration is not the right field for you. And by the way, that's sad. I don't mean to make light of it. It's sad. But I think now what we're looking at is, with the attention that has been put on elections administration at a level that we've never had before, whatever it is in people that draws them to running into a burning building, you know, going out on our streets and protecting us at night and you know, potentially facing bullets whizzing by their head. That same drive that we have in people to strive for something bigger than ourselves, I think it's that same sort of drive that we're looking for now and that I think is starting to draw young people to this profession. Look, the standard saying is nobody ever grew up wanting to be an elections administrator, right? They made a wrong turn somewhere, ended up in it. Now we're starting to see the leading edge now of the first generation ever. I had one come up to me at class last week who said, I want to do a career in elections administration.
Really?
Can't tell you how happy that made me.
It sounds like you're taking the same kind of approach, or at least a similar kind of approach, to recruiting, for example, police officers or firefighters or teachers, people who kind of are in the realm of public service.
Yeah, that's right. I mean, I would argue that right now getting into elections administration is one of the most important jobs you can do in public service. For generations, it was taken as accepted that the results were accurate, that the elections were safe and secure. Now that that's being questioned by some, and I would argue by many, for all the wrong reasons, that's why we need people like that who want to make a difference. And if they do want to make a difference, elections administration is the way to do it.
Do you think that trust can ultimately be restored in elections and in the people who administer them?
I do believe that trust can be restored. First of all, it's already there with the majority of Americans. As a Republican, it makes me sad to say that the majority of the people who are questioning our election system right now are Republicans. So I think that's important for me as a Republican, as a registered Republican, to be stepping into this new role and talking as a Republican about what we can do to restore that trust in elections.
So what, in your mind, are the best ways to try to do that? I mean, how do you try to take people who are skeptical of results and the people who administer elections and try to convince them, no, everything is on the up and up here?
Now, I can't do this with everyone, but I think the best way to do it is to ask them to come and join me and come and see how we do things at the Maricopa County Tabulation Center. And we've done that over the last few years, taking hundreds, if not, you know, over 1,000 people through all sorts of different groups from around the county to show them the process. So bottom line is, more information, educating people, is the best way to address this challenge.
Do you see what you're doing now in some way as kind of a continuation of your service on the Board of Supervisors? I mean, you've been pretty open about why you chose not to run again, some of the threats and, you know, terrible things people have said and done to and about you and your family after recent elections. Do you see this as sort of a way to continue doing it, maybe just in the background?
I do see this as a way to continue to support that next generation. I think it would be a shame for the experiences that I've had, the stories that I have been a part of, the lessons that I've learned. It would be a shame for me to just, you know, sort of say, I don't want everyone to talk about this. Again, I have been open about how it was a traumatic situation for me and my family, but I've been open about it. I have sought help for it, and I'm in a good place, and I feel like this is the best thing that I can do right now, is to share this information and potentially inspire a new generation to get into this field, which is so important right now.
I wonder if in some ways you feel like maybe you can make more of a difference doing this than you could sitting on the County Board of Supervisors.
Well, that's hard to say. As I mention quite often, we're in 50 lines of business at the Board of Supervisors. Elections is kind of what we've become known as.
Yeah.
But being able to work in all these different areas, both of my time on the Board of Supervisors and City Council, I'm very grateful for that service. And I think this is the right place for this to happen, right here in Maricopa County, where there have been so many events that have been central to both the challenges that we faced in elections, but I would argue also some of the successes that we've had and the way that we've learned how to push back to, for example, the way that we were live tweeting during the so-called hearings that the state Senate would hold during the Cyber Ninja audit, and the way that we've continued to be extremely transparent. 2022, we ran the most transparent election we ever have, and we're going to do that again in 2024.
That's Maricopa County Supervisor Bill Gates. He's also now the director of ASU's Mechanics of Democracy Laboratory. We'll have more of our conversation in just a moment.
Good morning. It's the show on KJZZ 91.5. I'm Lauren Gilger.
And I'm Mark Brody. Let's return now to my conversation with Maricopa County Supervisor Bill Gates. He's leaving his position at the end of the year after deciding against running for a third term. In its place, he's leading the new Mechanics of Democracy Laboratory, or model program, at ASU. But he'll still be on the board as it oversees certification of the 2024 election this fall. And when Gates and I spoke recently, I asked what worries him about the general election coming up in November for Maricopa County.
I don't really like the word worry, but what am I focused on and what is the team focused on? Number one issue, and I'm starting to see people talk about it in the media, which I think is great, is the fact that we're going to have two, when you go to vote in November or in October, if you're an early voter, you're going to have two pieces of paper with races on both of those pieces of paper because there are so many. Not only the ones I think a lot of people are thinking about, presidential, U.S. Senate, things like that. We have judicial retention elections. We have all of the different initiatives and referenda. So I'm concerned that people – I want to make sure that they see that they have those two pieces of paper and they vote every single race that they want to. That is one of the major focuses. And admittedly, we continue to be very focused on security both of our workers and of our voters.
As I'm sure you know, there are still people who are pushing conspiracy theories about elections both past and future. I'm wondering if, I know you don't like the word worried, but are you maybe concerned about if a particular candidate loses in November, what the result of that might be, given what we've seen over the past couple of cycles?
Unfortunately, this has now been a reality in the last couple of cycles as we have had candidates who've been on the losing end and have refused to concede. They've refused to accept the results. So honestly, I wouldn't be surprised if that happens again. We've seen this before. All we can do is do our level best and communicate to folks what's going on. One of the issues in particular for us here in Arizona is the time that it takes for the results. And that's something that we'll continue to educate people about. But unfortunately, those who would try and create chaos in our election system seize upon that as a suggestion that there's something going on, that the election is being rigged. That's simply not the case. But because we've been through this both in 2020 and in 2022, we won't be surprised by it. And we'll be prepared for it. And the way we prepare for it is that we continue to do our jobs and we continue to put the truth out there.
I was going to ask you if you feel like you've learned anything from the last two election cycles, specifically about not just sort of transparency and how people might respond, but also maybe more pragmatic things about like what kind of security you need or things like, you know, having a live stream up or technological issues that maybe can help alleviate some of the issues that people out there are having.
Yeah, I would say in general, it's changed almost everything that we do in one way or the other. The way that we communicate, as you reference, it's so much broader than we ever did before. The security, if you came down to Maricopa County Tabulation Center, I could show you the fences we've had to add, the badging that we've had to add, the metal detectors. It makes me sad. I wish we didn't have to do it. But that's what we owe to our workers, the workers who spend 14 to 16 hour days during the election tabulating it and doing all the various roles, making sure that people outside of the center can't take pictures of them, take pictures of their license plates. That's unacceptable. Our people deserve better. And so we have taken a lot of measures. And we just know that we've got to continue to do what's right. We've got to continue to do our jobs. And we can't lose that focus. No matter what people say, even including nominees of one party or the other for federal offices.
If somebody had told you, let's say 10 years ago, that this is where you would be right now, that you had decided voluntarily to leave office, you're going to be starting a program at ASU to try to train the next generation of election workers and restore trust in elections. What would 10 years ago Bill Gates have thought about that?
I would have been very surprised by that. Now, before I was on the Phoenix City Council, I was actually an election day lawyer for the Republican Party. So I would have been excited to hear that I was working in elections. But then if you explained to me in a little more detail what had led me to this, I would have been saddened by it. But I also would have been pleased that this was the direction that I chose to take, that Arizona State University was going to allow me to do this, support these efforts. And I have to tell you, the reaction from folks in the community and across the country has been wonderful.
I know that in the past you've described yourself as a Reagan Republican, and maybe you still consider yourself a Reagan Republican.
I do.
And given what you have done in the past, you mentioned you were an Election Day lawyer for the Republican Party. I'm curious what you make of sort of where you fit in the GOP right now.
It's been a challenging situation, I think, for those of us who have been active in the party, have been elected official for many years. We've seen a shift in the party that is not really consistent with my view of where the party ought to be, what our focus ought to be. But as I remind people all the time, right now my role, my major role as a member of the Board of Supervisors, is to support the whole elections team and make sure that our focus is on that and making sure that whoever it is that the people of Maricopa County vote for to be their elected officials, that they have that opportunity to vote, the votes are tabulated, and then those new folks will be sworn in 2025.
Do you ever get pushback, I wonder, from people on the left who maybe think because you have sort of fallen out of favor with, at least with the base of the Republican Party, they assume that you've suddenly become a Democrat and have like abandoned all of the values that you've had for your entire life in the Republican Party?
Well, I don't think I've had too much of that. I think that people understand, if they do wonder that, you know, when we talk about policy issues, I think they're reminded that I'm still a conservative Republican.
Yeah.
That's what I consider myself. But it is, this has been one of the hardest things for it, and frankly, one of the most traumatic things I've talked about that, is that these folks that are in my party, these people that I worked with, these people that I campaigned for, either, you know, started to allege that my colleagues and I were involved in rigging an election and had, you know, were basically had no integrity anymore, or simply sat silent while others did accuse us of those things. That's very challenging, but I know there's several of us who've had this similar kind of experience, many of my colleagues, Stephen Richer, Rusty Bowers. And in the end, all we did was we just did what's right. I know for me, I don't feel like I did anything heroic. I just did my job. We followed the law, and that is our responsibility. That's the oath that we took, to follow the law and the Constitution. That's what I'm going to continue to do through December 31st of this year.
All right. That is Bill Gates, Maricopa County Supervisor, also Director of ASU's new Mechanics of Democracy Laboratory, the Model Program. Bill, thanks for coming in. I really appreciate it.
Thanks for having me.
The Musical Instrument Museum is currently running an exhibition featuring stringed instruments played by some of the most famous jazz, folk, and bluegrass artists in American history. The show's Sam Dingman recently visited the museum, and the show left quite an impression on him.
I was a film studies major in college, which wasn't the most practical choice. But there is this one idea from my film classes that has always stuck with me. It's something cinematographers talk about called indexical signs. An indexical sign is a concrete object that proves the existence of something that would otherwise be hard to define. The example I remember my professor giving is a weather vane. A weather vane is an indexical sign of wind. "Think about it," she said. "Can you describe what wind is?" "No. But we know it exists because of weather vanes." A couple weeks ago at the Musical Instrument Museum, I took a tour of an exhibition called Acoustic America: Iconic Guitars, Mandolins, and Banjos. And I found myself thinking about weather vanes.
People certainly see the tangible musical instruments, but we really strongly believe that that's our way of introducing people to human beings from around the world. So they stand for the people.
That's Rich Walter, the curator of the exhibition. He's leading me through a gallery full of guitars, mandolins, and banjos that were once played by artists like Earl Scruggs, David Grisman, and Mississippi John Hurt. And for a show about music, the gallery is oddly quiet. It's just a series of stringed instruments mounted on walls and platforms. But the whole thing is somehow mesmerizing.
The old guitar. Does this have a set list attached to it?
It does. So these are Peter, Paul, and Mary. This is Peter Yarrow's guitar.
They didn't close with Jet Plane. I would have closed with Jet Plane.
Standing there in the otherwise silent gallery, I hear the opening strains of Leaving on a Jet Plane in my head, and my eyes get misty. I remember this dream I had when I was 17 about being married to this girl that I had a crush on, and in the dream, she tells me that she loves me, but she doesn't think our marriage is working for her anymore. And then, as if to underscore that point, she pulls out a guitar and starts playing Leaving on a Jet Plane. I haven't been able to listen to that song ever since I had that dream. Literally, I have burst into tears in the middle of crowded concerts and had to leave the room when people play covers of Leaving on a Jet Plane. And now I'm staring at the guitar that Peter Yarrow used to play it on. It's an indexical sign of unrequited love.
Musical instruments at their core are just filled with potential. And so there's a lot of, I think, room for imagination, both thinking about the static object and what you might do with it, but also imagining that very same thing 50 years ago in the hands of a real virtuosic player who made history with it.
One of the other things that really sticks out to me about this exhibition and these instruments is, by and large, the materials are wood, negative space inside of the instrument, and in the case of the banjo, skin.
Right.
And from these very earthly materials comes this transcendent sound.
Yeah. I think all of that is special. The organic nature of it, the fact that it's fingertips, you know, and it's, you're holding things in your lap. They're intimate, you know, and these wooden resonating things that vibrate because of how you use them with your hands and your fingertips. It's just such a direct human connection.
I have never been much of a guitarist, but I am obsessed with microphones. There is something about the way the human voice sounds on the radio. It's godlike somehow, detached from the limitations of the physical plane, floating in the air. But it's also so familiar. Someone else's voice somehow feels like your voice in your own head. The story they're telling becomes a part of your story. The conversation they're having feels like you're having it too. It's hard to explain, but that's why I love microphones. They're indexical signs of whatever that is. When I first got into recording, I wanted to figure out what microphone I needed to talk into to get that sound. I did a lot of research and found out that many radio stations use this one microphone called an Electrovoice RE20. I watched every single YouTube video I could find that showed people talking into RE20s. I spent hours listening to stuff like this.
This is an Electrovoice RE20. I'm speaking about 10 inches away from it. It is going into my usual preamp, a requisite PAL Plus Mark III. See Slap Happy the Chimp and his Monkey Time pals all this week on Nickelodeon.
When I discovered the RE20, I thought, there it is, that big, round, silky sound. So I saved up all my money and I bought an RE20. And I will never forget the moment when I plugged it in for the first time. I put on my headphones, I started talking, and I sounded nothing like the voices on the radio. That was 15 years ago. I'm still chasing that sound. That day in the gallery with Rich, staring at the guitars that made some of the sweetest sounds that have ever been recorded, I start to wonder what exactly I've been chasing.
They're just objects on stands, which to me highlights the specific relationship that each one of them would have to the person who plays them. Because, you know, part of me when I walked in, truthfully, was like, oh, it would be so nice to hear them being played in this room. But it feels like part of what you're after is the recognition that they don't just have a sound. They sound a certain way when a certain person plays them, and that's a different thing.
Yeah, I mean, they don't have one sound available to them. And when you see them displayed in the gallery as they are, it has this presence. And it's as close as we can be in some cases, these artists who've passed away. There it is. That's what they held. That intimacy thing, there's something really powerful about these instruments that the finish was worn off by the hands of this great person. You're looking at this thing that bears witness to a lot of nights and a lot of days and a lot of practice and a lot of use, you know? And so you're seeing the evidence of these people holding them, using them, and animating them with music.
Here on the show recently, I talked to one of my favorite musicians, Joshua Redman, about his relationship with his instrument. And he said this sort of mystical thing.
I think ultimately what I'm striving for, and I think what a lot of us are striving for, is for the instrument to disappear.
And looking back, I think that's what feels so spiritual about staring at the instruments at the Musical Instrument Museum. It's not what they are or how they're made. It's that they're there at all. Because in the hands of the people who played them, they disappeared. When I sat down to record this piece, I got an idea. I pulled out my old RE20, and I talked into it for the first time since I started working here at KJZZ. You're hearing it right now. And as I speak these words, I still don't know if I will ever sound like that radio voice that I have in my head. I'm still not sure what I'm chasing. But thanks to Rich, I'm starting to understand why I can't stop chasing it.
You're remembering a sound. Mm-hmm. And I think as humans, we're so conditioned, we have that apparatus. Our brains are so sensitive to direct sounds, the sound of a parent's voice, the sound of weather coming through the air. Like, we're sensitive to direct natural sounds. And I think a lot of these instruments do that. It's a vibrating string, and that's it. And it's the way a human being gets that string vibrating that can be very powerful and very direct and leave very intense emotional impressions.
Acoustic America, iconic guitars, mandolins, and banjos, is on display at the Musical Instrument Museum through this Sunday. For KJZZ's The Show, I'm Sam Dingman.
And this is The Show.
Good morning. It's The Show on KJZZ 91.5. I'm Mark Brody.
And I'm Lauren Gilger. Where is the line between truth and deception, fact and fiction? Those are some of the big questions author Sarah Vereen tackles in her 2023 memoir, To Name the Bigger Lie. Vereen is a professor of creative writing at Arizona State University, where her wife, Marta, teaches as well. Their lives were derailed when they found out Marta was being investigated under Title IX for sexual misconduct. While she knew the allegations against her must be lies, her increasingly desperate attempts to prove their innocence made Vereen question everything, even what she knows to be true. Eventually, she uncovered the person behind the accusations, a man who was competing with Vereen for a professor job at the University of Michigan. But proving that becomes something else entirely. I spoke last year with Vereen about the book, which is out this month in paperback.
Also works at ASU, got an email from someone who we still don't know who this person is, but this person reached out and let us know that people were writing about Marta on Reddit, on the ASU Reddit page, and saying that she was under investigation for a Title IX violation.
Hmm. What did you think about it when you started to dig into this, like looking at those posts, looking at, they were anonymous, right? But the things that they said, it sounds like it was pretty clear right away to you that this was suspicious.
Yeah, you know, from the start, it all felt invented and kind of surreal. I kept feeling like I would wake up from a dream, but the longer it lasted and the more complicated it got, in the subsequent days, we found out that Marta was in fact under a Title IX investigation. And then we found out that another university where we were being considered for a job had received emails about her saying that she was under investigation. So the more sort of evidence that piled up regarding this story, the more worried I got and the more real it started to feel, even as I knew that there was no way it could be true.
Yeah. Okay, so let's talk about what a Title IX investigation means, right? Like, this is kind of commonplace in universities, but lots of people are not familiar with that. And it has big implications in terms of how the investigation plays out. Like, this is not like a legal investigation in a court of law, right? There's some differences.
Right. So Title IX is essentially an education law that was passed to make sure that gender is not a factor in the quality of education you receive. And at its start, it was mostly focused on sports. But over the years, it's changed a little bit. And especially when we started to realize that there was a real problem with sexual assault on college campuses, the law was more broadly interpreted to allow for investigations when universities became aware that students were being sexually harassed, sexually assaulted, or facing any sort of sexual misconduct. And the idea was that universities should be responsible for that. They shouldn't allow those sort of things to happen. So what happens in a Title IX investigation is usually that university receives some sort of complaint and they investigate it, and the entire investigation is administrative, and that the results could be that there's some sort of repercussion for the employee if an employee is involved, or for students. Students can sometimes be suspended. There's different sort of repercussions for them if they're involved and found, quote unquote, guilty.
Did you ever expect this to kind of come home to your own family, though?
No. I mean, I think that, you know, my experience with Title IX had always been thinking of myself as one of these reporters, thinking that perhaps my students might be facing a situation that needed to be reported and that I needed to find resources for them. That's always the relationship that I had with Title IX. You know, in some ways, I think abstractly or intellectually, I was indebted to it because I know that Title IX has now made it illegal for me to be harassed, you know, as an educator or as a student, and has allowed for those sort of protections that people like my mom or generations before didn't have.
Yeah.
So I was very aware of that intellectually, but I never, ever, ever thought that I could be on the other end of a Title IX investigation. And it wasn't until this all happened that I realized how few protections there are for those that have been accused, because this is not in a court of law. It's not working the way that a case would in the court of law. And so we were even told at some point that we couldn't have a lawyer present, which I later was heard was not true, but the ability to sort of defend yourself within that system is a lot more difficult than I realized.
Yeah. Tell us a little bit about the sort of personal implications of this, like for your family. Like, I mean, you had to go through this process. It was, I'm sure, incredibly, as you said, surreal is the first word that came to mind. But how did this affect your family, your relationships?
What started to happen during that process of the investigation is that I began to doubt Marta and then also myself. There were a couple key moments, one in which I started to doubt my own memory when one sort of element or fact that was part of the investigation lined up with something that was actually real in real life. It confused me in this way that was really bewildering. And for a moment, I doubted myself in a way that felt completely surreal. And then I also doubted Marta. At the beginning, from the start, I never doubted her. I thought it was, most of the accusations didn't make sense. But the longer it lasted, the more I began to have these sort of nagging doubts that I would be able to know when I thought about them, I would know they weren't valid. I would know that I could trust her. I could know I could trust myself, but I still found myself falling into moments of doubt that were probably the scariest part.
So at the same time, this book is also about your own story, right? About your almost like coming of age story. You weave in a really interesting way, this teacher that you had in high school, a philosophy teacher, who sort of, it sounds like, affected the way that you ended up looking at this. And you were writing a book about him, it sounds like, when this all happened. How does this tie together?
So when this all happened, I was in the middle of a book about this teacher, my philosophy teacher in high school, who had really influenced the way I thought about the world and my interest in what is true and what is real, but had started teaching conspiracy theories about halfway through my high school education. In a way that was similarly bewildering. So I was already thinking about those questions of like, what happens when somebody manipulates what is real or what is true? What happens when somebody lies? How do we deal with that? And so when this experience happened with Marta and me, when we were falsely accused, in the middle of that, I just started to feel a similar sort of bewilderment that I felt and a similar sort of fear that I felt in high school when I was trapped by that teacher's manipulations and lies. And so I decided that the two stories would be helpful if they were told together. I thought there was a way in which if I explored my teacher and what he did, that might also help me understand the man that I call Jay in the book and what he did to Martin and me 25 years later.
That was Sarah Vereen, an ASU professor and the author of To Name the Bigger Lie.
And that'll do it for this Thursday edition of the show. Thank you, as always, for being here. For Lauren Gilger, I'm Mark Brody. Have a terrific rest of your day. Hope to have you right back here tomorrow.